Welcome to the Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery, where every death had a life and every life had a story. My name is Jenny Johnson.
Hi, and I'm Diane Hartshorn.
And today we have a very special guest with us. I found out about this particular guest through a blog post that she had written, and it totally enthralled me. And I contacted her and asked her if she would be willing to come on to the show and share that the particular story that I read on her blog. But she's going to add to that and talk about the Genoa Cemetery in Genoa, Nevada. And she's going to tell us about that cemetery, as well as the stone carver that she researched and wrote about, and a whole bunch of other fascinating stuff. So everybody, I would like to introduce you to Karen Dustman. Karen, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and also how you got into researching cemeteries and headstones?
Thank you for having me on. So I got originally fascinated with headstones when I was a little girl. We grew up in a town beside a river in New England. And when I was a kid, my sisters and I used to walk down beside the river, and there was this old, old cemetery down there with only two or three headstones left. And I remember seeing, when I was about 10 years old or so, there was a headstone for a fellow named William Peck. And it had more information on this headstone than sometimes you see on headstones. It had not only his death date, but it had the fact that he died when he was 21 years old on board the good ship Sally. And so that struck my imagination, like, who was this guy? He was so young, just 21. And what the heck was he doing on board the good ship Sally? So that kind of piqued my interest in headstones. And then a lot of years went by and real life kind of intervened and real jobs kind of intervened. And I got re-interested in headstones in particular when my husband and I moved here to the Eastern Sierra portion of California. And if you think of California as kind of like the crook of a bent arm, we're right in the elbow section of the arm, just right a few miles away from the Nevada border. And we moved here in about 2001. And we began getting interested in local history, and there hadn't been too much written about this area. So we began studying and researching and began writing. The first book that I did that was a self-published book was about Silver Mountain City, which is a Comstock era silver mining town that was the original county seat of Alpine County. And as part of that research, I got to know some of the people who were original settlers in this area. And there's an old cemetery here that was actually founded about in the 1890s. Called the Fredericksburg Cemetery. And so I thought I would do a little walking tour booklet of that or book of that and get to know some of the people as while I was doing it. So the research helped me learn about the local people, but it was also a walking tour to acquaint people with this really fascinating, beautiful, small cemetery. And like you said, each one's life and each one's a story. So it was a great way to learn the stories of the people who were here originally. And then some friends and I decided we would take that same principle and try to do a larger cemetery, which was the Genoa Cemetery. So let me tell you a little bit about Genoa, and then I'll tell you a little about the cemetery. Genoa was actually a spinoff from both the Gold Rush and the Silver Rush after gold was discovered in California in January of 1848. There was a party of Mormons who were part of the original Mormon battalion who were going back to Salt Lake City. And they came through this area, through Alpine County area, in August of 1848. And they brought with them word of the discovery of gold, of course, but also as they went back to Salt Lake, they brought with them the story of Carson Valley, this beautiful valley that they had gone through. So when they came through, they created a whole new trail over the Sierras, going from west to east, going back to Salt Lake. And the trail that they blazed actually opened a new emigrant route to the gold country for the oncoming immigrants. So it was more preferable. It had less river crossings than the old Donner Truckee route. And it didn't have the negative association of the Donner Party with it. So people were eager to take this route, and it became very, very popular. So traders, people who were in the business of selling goods to the immigrants, took note of the number of immigrants that were coming this way. And there were thousands and thousands of them. And in 1849, a Mormon fellow named Hampton Beatty and some of his partners built a very small 20 by 40 foot log cabin at the foot of Sierras as a station to sell goods to the oncoming immigrants. And his trading post was a huge success, but it was only temporary. So the Carson route of the immigrant trail took off. And the next year in July of 1850, there were at least five different trading posts beside the immigrant trail in the Carson Valley area. And this, of course, word of this got back to Salt Lake City. And in the summer of 1851, John Reese and a larger party of Mormons settled at the base of the Sierra, and they built a new fort there at a spot that became known as Mormon Station. The old one where Hampton Beatty and his partners had been burned. So this was in possibly a different location. And there's actually some dispute among historians about whether it was the same location or a different location, but we think it probably was a little different. So their trading post, Mormon Station, became a settlement, grew up around the station, and eventually morphed into the town of Genoa. So that was 1851 when Reese and his party arrived, and all the gold rush, although the gold rush to California pretty soon started settling down. Over the next few years, the silver rush to Nevada and the Comstock began, and people were coming over the mountains now the opposite direction. So instead of going from east to west to the gold country, now they were going from the gold country to the new silver rush. So there had been some sporadic discoveries of gold in Nevada as early as 1850 at Gold Hill and elsewhere, but it turned out that there was silver here too, and that was really the big boom. And the resulting Comstock lode boom began about June of 1859. So as you can imagine, that news was really good for Genoa too. It had been a trading post for the immigrants, and now it was roughly 30 miles away from booming Virginia City. So it benefited from trade there and helped to supply all those mines. So Genoa was the first settlement of what eventually became the state of Nevada. Statehood was granted in October of 1864, and it became our 36th state. And that was in the middle of the Civil War, of course. And obviously people in Genoa, they were there pretty early, and eventually some people died. The earliest cemetery that we know of in Genoa was on Nixon Street, which today is in the heart of town, the residential section of town, in the very center of the town that kind of built up around that. That was considered the Mormon cemetery. And they also had a Chinese section. They had quite a number of Chinese settlers there as well.
Right.
So eventually either, we're not quite sure what happened. They either ran out of room in that small cemetery, or they wanted the land for building there. Or it's possible that some people didn't want the association of being buried in the Mormon cemetery. There were some people who didn't like that. And so about 1865, at least that early, maybe even earlier than that, some burials were informally taking place to the north of town, a little farther out. It was a very rocky plot of land. It was owned by a fellow who later became the state senator, J.W. Haynes. And because it was rocky, it wasn't really desirable for farming. So it made a good spot in that sense. It wasn't going to be used for something else. It was kind of a bad spot for a cemetery, though, because all those rocks made it really hard to dig graves.
Right. You got to move the rocks before you even get to the grave.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's still a problem with the cemetery today. It's still in use as an active cemetery, and de-rocking the plot is required before you're going to bury somebody there. And it's always been a huge problem. They could hit rocks literally as big as Volkswagens there. So very rocky area.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. Anyway. And no silver or gold in those rocks, huh?
No silver, no silver or gold there. So they began burying people there at least as early as 1865. And if you look at the heading of the cemetery, they've got one of those big arch signs over the driveway going in, and it says established 1865. It may have been a little earlier than that. We don't know. But then about the 1880s, remember, they still had that earlier graveyard, the one on Nixon Street. About the 1880s, they started moving the graves from that to this new cemetery at the north end of town. And it was a really slow transition. It didn't happen all at once, as nearly as we can tell. That process of moving people continued as late as 1910, or possibly even later. And it may have been family groups moving family members. It may have been people with one of the associations, the Odd Fellows or the Masons. But in any event, it was a very slow transition. And this second cemetery didn't actually become officially a cemetery until 1897, when Haynes and his wife deeded 7 acres of their ranch, making it official, for a dollar to Douglas County and to two fraternal organizations, the Masons and the Odd Fellows.
It's interesting that it took so long to move the one cemetery over to the new place. Usually, I mean, usually most of them that did that set a timeline and said, okay, we're going to move everybody. If you want to move, you come do it. Otherwise, we're just going to do it. So I find it fascinating. It took them, 30 years?
It took a long time.
To move graves from one spot to another?
And, yeah. And there's some suspicion that not all of the graves were moved. There's a couple of people. There was one very, they called him Bad Man Sam Brown, one outlaw in the area that nobody liked. And when he died in a shootout, actually, they buried him at the old Nixon Cemetery. And there's a story, at least, that he was deliberately left behind.
Oh, wow.
When they moved the other graves. They didn't want him with everybody
else. So one day when they're renovating something in the middle of town, yeah, and they come across some bones.
There he is.
We like so many old cemeteries, the records of this cemetery are really scanty at this point. The old records were destroyed. There was a serious fire in Genoa that burned the courthouse and all the court records in 1910. So all those early, early records, whatever they had, were gone in that fire. And by the early 1900s, the cemetery was in pretty poor shape. Many of the old wooden markers, unfortunately, also went away in the 1930s. There was a very well-intentioned cleanup of the cemetery by some Works Progress Administration workers. And they not only removed all the old sagebrush and put it in a big heap, but they added all the old wooden gravestones that they felt were just rubbish at this point. Maybe they were old enough not to be able to be read well or something, but they put them in a big heap and they lit them on fire. So that didn't help the cemetery records either. But luckily, in the 1940s, a group of people got together and formed a cemetery association and collected whatever records they could. And they also advertised in the paper and they asked for local families who had loved ones buried there to come forward and help them document what they knew, at least from oral history and oral records. Right. So they did a pretty good job of assembling what they could of the records. But because some of it was based on memory and some of it was based on a little bit of guesswork, it's not all perfect. And I'm going to tell you a story a little bit later about George Herman, whose marker is not where his grave actually is.
Oh, yes.
So as I was doing the research on the people in the cemetery for the book, one of the offshoots of all that was about Mr. Lindsay. So I kept seeing newspaper notices that William Lindsay was placing markers at Genoa Cemetery and at other cemeteries as well. So his name kept cropping up, like, who the heck was this guy? It was not just in Nevada, but it was also in California and other places. And I knew some of the markers that they were talking about him setting. They would say he was here to set Mrs. Christensen's marker, for example. And I knew them, and I knew that they were really beautiful markers. So I thought he would make a good blog story. And I'm a really good storyteller and I'm a pretty decent researcher, but I have to admit, I've been very lucky to have a friend who's extremely good at research on ancestry and other sources. And so she helped me compile the information about William Lindsay. And it's a lot more than I would have found myself, I'll tell you that.
Thank you, friend.
Yes, definitely.
Exactly. It's good to have friends who like to do the same stuff.
The Nancy Drew of the archives.
Exactly. There's a lot of sleuth work involved in this. So yes. Lindsay himself was born in 1842 in Columbus, Ohio, and he joined the Union Infantry during the Civil War as part of a detachment of Illinois volunteers. And he joined kind of late in the war. He joined in January of 1864, almost as the war was kind of winding down. And he mustered out 2 years later at Baton Rouge. And I'm guessing that he was a young man then, but he was possibly trained as a stoneworker before that. Maybe his father had been a stoneworker. I don't really know. But he immediately went to work after he got out of the army, cutting marble. And he was credited with one of the finest soldiers' monuments in Illinois. He later moved to California. And we know that because he shows up in both the 1870 and the 1880 censuses. And his occupation is listed both times as a marble cutter. And then in 1883, he started showing up in our local newspapers here in the Nevada area in Reno. So I don't really know why he came from California to Reno area or was interested in Nevada area, but it's possible that Reno was kind of taking off as a city. It may have been a business opportunity for him back then, or maybe he was just looking to start over in a fresh place. But in any event, he opened a marble works in Reno in July of 1884, and he started taking orders. And by now he was able to advertise himself as a very skilled marble cutter. He had 18 years under his belt. So pretty soon he was placing monuments all over Genoa and also elsewhere in the state. And he did so well that before long, the newspaper was telling us that he was hiring help and that even his father had moved out from California to help take orders for him. His father went on like a circuit driving around taking orders for headstones.
That is not the salesman you think of when you think of old the old timey salesman. You don't think of somebody going around taking orders for headstones.
I know.
I can picture him on the train scene in what's that musical? The Music Man at the beginning, and the salesman in the car, the train car. I can just picture him sitting there going town to town selling headstones.
Well, they did the headstone. It was kind of hard to get one unless you knew the right guy, I guess. I don't know.
True.
Lindsay began expanding his business, and we were talking before about maybe sort of some sort of vertical integration. He realized that there was an opportunity here to acquire other parts of the business. And so he began buying up marble quarries to serve as supply for his business as far as Mono County, which is 150 miles away. And one of those quarries he bought was known for its very special sky blue marble. It just sounds so beautiful, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm, it does.
It does.
And there was another vein in that same quarry that supposedly had 14 different colors of marble. So I think of him as sort of an artistic guy who just had an eye for stone and was taken by the colors mm-hmm. and the different varieties. So he built a full-fledged quarry there in Mono County with a mill and saws and polishers. And it even had a blacksmith shop and a boarding house. So that's how many people he was using as skilled labor. He had a boarding house for his laborers. And he began shipping the stone. He began shipping the stone to Reno. And one of the advantages of Reno would have been that it had a railroad. So it could serve, you could ship stone to other places in the country as well.
Right.
One of the slabs of marble that he cut at that quarry weighed as much as 25 tons. And the newspaper mentioned its size. It was 16 feet long by 4 feet by 4.5 feet. So you imagine this huge block of stone and moving it with that old equipment and horses and whatever else you used to
use. I'm just trying to imagine how they even got it onto like the train car itself. Because that's a huge weight. I'm assuming there was some sort of pulley system, but good grief.
It had to be a block and tackle and something to lift it with. I think those old... Monumental News, I think they have pictures of some of that equipment in there. So you might want to look at that.
Oh, cool. I might have to go check that out. Yeah.
So Lindsay kept expanding and he kept looking for other opportunity and other quarries, buying them elsewhere in Nevada. And he bought one near Mina, Nevada, which is way out, that produced something they described as black Egyptian marble. Now, it wasn't actually from Egypt, obviously, but it must have resembled something that they had from Egypt.
Right.
And it was just sounded beautiful in the description. It was laced with green and copper and gold colored veins. So it would have made a beautiful headstone for sure.
Mm-hmm.
One of those blocks was even larger. It was 45 tons and he shipped it back east. The interesting thing for me was I assumed as I was doing the original research that he had done all these headstone carvings himself or with the labor that he hired. But I think that's probably actually not true. The advertisements in the trade magazines, when I saw some of those, like the Monumental News in the 1890s, they look pretty darn familiar. They look very similar to some of the stones that he placed. So what I learned in doing this was that pre-carved stones could be ordered and shipped across country by rail. In fact, one of Lindsay's own ads was very honest about it, and he even boasted finished work shipped direct from New York, suggesting that the actual carving had been done back east. So he probably added the names and the dates and maybe anything else that people wanted etched on the stone, but it probably came pre-shaped.
Right.
So in 1893, Lindsay moved south from Reno to Carson City. And by now he had another quarry that he bought, which was down near Bridgeport, California. And that one produced travertine. And he began entering exhibits of his beautiful stonework into various fairs. So he won a gold medal at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, and he won another gold medal at the San Francisco Midwinter Exposition in 1894, all of which was good for his reputation with his fellow stonecutters, of course, but it's also very good for advertising. And he made sure to mention that in his advertisements, were gold medal award-winning stonecutters.
Oh, yes.
Stone, not just stonecutters, but stone. And what he was demonstrating at these fairs wasn't actually carved stones. It was just big blocks of stone and the beautiful colors.
Mm-hmm.
By now he was getting older. And by 1900, he would have been in his late 50s. And he sold his Mono County quarry for $8,000 in 1901, which would have been nearly $250,000 today.
Wow.
In early 1909, he also sold that black Egyptian marble quarry near Mina, Nevada. And that was one of the last acts that he did in life. And I have often wondered if he sort of knew that death was approaching at that point. He certainly probably wasn't feeling very well.
Mm-hmm.
He died on June 15th of 1909 after an operation of some sort. And he's buried over in Oakland, along with his wife, who followed him in death about 2 years later. And she's buried beside him. And interestingly enough, for all the beautiful large stone monuments that he made and he placed, His own monument is very small and very simple. It's just a simple square block with his name on it and the dates. And I've always wondered, I don't know for sure, this is just a guess, but I wonder if he didn't carve that stone himself, knowing that death was approaching. It seems like I could see him as being kind of a humble guy, despite the beautiful monuments and huge works that he'd made elsewhere. I could see him doing that.
Right.
I wanted to tell you about one of the stones in particular at Genoa that William Lindsay placed, and that I think he probably carved himself. And that's a stone for a fellow named David Wally. It's what I call a wedding cake monument, because it just looks like the ornamentation that you would have on the top of a wedding cake. It's very, right. It's white marble. It's beautiful. It's got pillars. It's got a carved cap on it with sort of spindles on it. It's just gorgeous. But it's also very unusual. At least I have not seen any other examples of this type of carving. So I'm guessing he did it himself. So David Wally was a very early arrival at Genoa. He came in the winter of 1861 to 62, and he noticed there was a very famous set of hot springs south of Genoa, just south of the town. It was actually a hot springs that had been known by the local Native Americans. It had been known even before David Wally came to town in 1861. Other people had used it for baths or used it for medicinal hot springs.
Right.
But David was the one who decided to commercialize it. So he noticed the hot springs and he threw up a tent for privacy and began charging 50 cents a piece for baths in 1862.
I love that.
I know. Isn't that great?
50 yeah. cents to enter the tent and take a bath.
There you go. Well, and then nice warm water. That would have been great in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. It's cold here, so that would have been very nice.
True.
And he did so well that he was able to bring his wife, Harriet, out from New York in 1864. And together they built up a very booming spa business. In fact, they called it a hospital at one point. They touted the healing waters of these medicinal hot springs. And they built a large hotel so people could stay there. They would stay at the hot springs for not just days, but weeks or months, taking the waters.
Right.
And they would treat everything from rheumatism to alcoholism, of all things they thought could treat with the medicinal waters. They even had a ballroom there. And so locals would come and dance in their ballroom as well. And of course, they had the bathhouses and they had stables. And David Wally passed away rather unexpectedly in 1875. But Harriet continued the hotel business, and she was quite the businesswoman at a time when women didn't do that. She was kind of an amazing woman. So he left her not only the hotel, but he left her $18,000 in debt for the improvements of the hotel too. So she had her work definitely cut out for her. I know. She managed to keep the hotel running, and she managed to pay off that debt eventually, but it took her 22 years to do it, I guess, or a long time to do it.
Good for her, though.
Yes,
good
definitely.
For her.
She yeah.
was stubborn. And there was no headstone, except maybe possibly a wooden one, but there's no fancy headstone on David Wally's grave for the next 22 years until the late 1890s, so 1896 or so, she finally commissioned Lindsay to make this special wedding cake style monument. And she paid $500 for it, which would have been close to $15,000 today. And she paid it off just a few weeks before she herself died. So here again, I wonder if she'd been making the plans knowing that she was ill. She was 81 years old when she finally died in January of 1897. And so she's buried there too.
Sounds like she lived a long, pretty good life though. I mean, probably a little hard at times, but for the times, she was sounds like an amazing woman.
She was tenacious. Maybe those healing waters helped her, who knows?
She took enough baths.
She took enough baths. There you go. I wanted to tell you about a couple of other people who were buried at Genoa. They're not necessarily memorialized with stones that had anything to do with Lindsay, but they're it's a fascinating graveyard. If people come, I hope they'll stop and pay a visit. It's worth just strolling through. The most famous person who's buried at Genoa is a fellow named Snowshoe Thompson, who carried the mail for over 20 years over the Sierra in the middle of winter on skis. And he is known all around the world. He's a very, very famous guy. In fact, he's the one person at the cemetery that has, I know. And he never got paid for his work. He was supposed to be paid by the U.S. Postal Service, but he never was.
Oh, wow.
I know. Anyway, when you enter the cemetery, there actually are signs that direct you to his grave. But he's the only one that is famous in that sense, in larger sense, that's buried there. But there's some other people who are kind of notable, and there was one that was really a kind of a fun discovery for us. It's always fun when you can put the pieces of a mystery together, and this was sort of a mystery that mm-hmm. we feel good that we were able to help solve. As we were walking around, we could see there was one grave that was enclosed with 8 granite pillars. And the pillars were still there. They have holes in them, like there used to be a chain linking them together. There's no chain anymore, but the pillars are still there, and there was no headstone in the middle. We had no idea who was buried in this obviously clearly well-marked grave. And then the newspaper started putting some of the pieces, the old newspaper started putting some of the pieces together for us. So we discovered that the person who had originally bought the plot was a fellow named George Herman. He was a shoemaker in Gardnerville, Nevada, who died in 1897. His fiancée, he'd been engaged to marry this young woman named Mary Ellis, who died 20 years before, 1875, before they were able to be married. So he lost the love of his life, and he had erected mm-hmm. the 8 granite posts around the outside of a double plot, figuring after she was buried, and then he would be buried beside her when he eventually died. But in the meantime, a fellow shoemaker named H.F. Spencer passed away. So George Herman was a nice guy, and he allowed George H.F. Spencer to be buried in the vacant spot that was originally going to be his spot next to Mary Ellis, intending to just enlarge the enclosure later to make it go from 2 to 3. But he never got around to it before he died. So when George Herman passed away, his friends all chipped in, did the labor, moved the granite posts out, made a little room for George. So there was a third spot for George. So now we have 3 people in the cemetery in that plot. And then we just found out that there was actually a 4th person there as well. A fellow named Major Garland Slimmons died the year after George did. So he died in April of 1898. And he had been a bachelor too, just like George, and also like his friend H.F. Spencer. So since they'd all been good friends and they were all bachelors, when Slimmons died, I guess his friends decided that was a good place for him to spend eternity too. So they went ahead and enlarged it, and he's buried in the same 8 granite pillar spot as the other 3.
I love that.
And we only, isn't that great? Put names to it. So it's
such
one
a
of
fun story.
It is a fun story. It's fun to be able to fill in the pieces of the mystery. And we were able to confirm that because we have a friend who's functions basically the sexton of the cemetery. He arranges burials, and he's a sort of a caretaker for the cemetery. And he has a wonderful little black book with pencil entries in it that his father had actually kept before him of all the burials and some notations. And that little tiny, just almost anecdotal report has so much valuable information in it that's nowhere else. And so in the records for that particular 8 granite pillar cemetery plot, it had just one word. It had Herman. And they had always assumed that was somebody's first name, Herman somebody or other, but it wasn't. It was George Herman. So we're able to confirm that that really was George Herman. And I mentioned before that there are sometimes markers in the wrong spot, and that was true with George Herman as well. When the Cemetery Association began piecing together the records of the cemetery, they sometimes put up these concrete crosses that are in the shape of a cross, but painted white. And they would mark graves that they believed were the graves of somebody. And they did the best they could to mark what they thought at the time were the correct graves. Well, there's a concrete cross for George Herman at the very top of that section that's nowhere near exactly where he's actually buried. But it's beside a marker for a woman named Mary Isles. Now, you remember George Herman's girlfriend was Mary Ellis. So we think the reason that the marker got put in the wrong place was they knew he was next to Mary. And Ellis and Isles are so close, they thought, well, here's this pillar for Mary Isles. It must be George Herman's spot. So there's actually 2 spots in the cemetery that are associated with George Herman now.
And Mary Isles got herself a boyfriend she never expected to have.
I know. There you go. So one of the real joys for us in doing this has been to uncover some of the people who are buried there who are unknown burials. We don't know exactly where they are in the cemetery. We do know that they're there based on the newspaper reports. And so when we did our book, what we did was to put in the very back of the book the names of the people that we'd come across as we were preparing that book. They could be in that section. They could be in some other section. We really don't know where they are, but we do believe that they are buried in Genoa Cemetery somewhere. And we wanted to memorialize them and keep their stories alive as well as we could. So that's been one of the real joys for me, is to feel like those stories don't go untold.
Right. And just so our listeners know, Karen has published 3 books so far about the Genoa Cemetery, and you're working on getting the 4th one published, written and published. So there will eventually be 4 books, and it's been divided into sections. And so you can read about different sections. And if you happen to go visit Genoa, now you have a really good guide as to who those people are and those stories for all those people. And I've been reading one of her books, and the stories are just amazing. So definitely we will have a link in the show notes. So anybody who's interested can go to that link and order the books to read them themselves. And also there's a link for your blog there, and you can read the article about Lindsay that led me to Karen, but also there's some other fascinating articles you have on that blog. So definitely make sure you go check out those links and learn even more.
Well, thanks for the plug. I appreciate that.
Oh yeah, no problem. I mean, it's a lot of work to write. I've never actually written a book. I read a lot of books, but it's a lot of work. So we should plug it. We want people to read
them. We've enjoyed doing it so much. We have the books about the book about Fredericksburg Cemetery, as well as the book about Genoa Cemetery. And it's been a fun project. It's been kind of a group project for me and some friends. So we've really enjoyed doing them.
That's so awesome. So yes, listeners, please check out those show notes so you can check out those links and order those books. I mean, if you're a cemetery lover and you want to know these stories, it's a great place to get the stories. And the nice thing is the stories are, most of them are 1 or 2 pages. So it makes for easy, light reading where you read a couple of stories and you can put it down and go do other stuff and pick it up again later and read a few more stories. So it's a great way to do some reading. So we hope you'll go and check those out.
So perfect if you go visit the cemetery as well, too. That way you get to know all these people. That's really neat.
Yeah, it's almost more exciting because right. You know something about those headstones than when you're looking at them or photographing them. You have that story behind them. So that makes it that much more exciting to go visit the cemetery. Well, Karen, thank you so much.
Yeah, enjoyed it very much.
Thank you guys so much. Keep up the good work. We love your show. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much, Karen Dustman. We enjoyed this episode so very much, and I'm sure you have so much more to tell us. So hopefully you'll be able to join us once again. We have included links to Karen's book and her blog in today's show notes, which can be found on our website, theordinaryextraordinarycemetery.com.
And you can also visit us on social media. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery and on Twitter at Ord Extra Sim. And we would especially love it if you would visit us on one of the social media accounts or all of the social media accounts, your choice, and tell us what you would like as bonus material if we were to begin a Patreon subscription. It's something we've been toying with. We haven't done it yet, but we've discussed it, Diane and I. And I would like to know from listeners what that bonus content might be for you guys. Of course, our main podcast is always going to remain free. But we have been playing with the idea of the Patreon account in order to help cover production costs and to raise money for the restoration and preservation of historical cemeteries. So as our listening audience, what would be bonus material that you really would like access to? We welcome all of your ideas. So I hope to hear from that. And then as soon as we really get that going, we will let you guys know what we have going on with that.
And until we meet again.